anybody can do. I'll work on that, I say, and go back to fiddling with the rug. It's quiet again. I can literally hear the clock in his office ticking. 4 minutes of therapy left to go. 3 minutes. 2.
So do you have anything else you want to talk about?
Dave asks. Last chance, I think. Tell him about seeing Ty. No, I say. I'm good. Which has to be like lie number 17 in this session alone. Then I stand up, even though I still have 96 seconds left, and walk away from therapy as fast as I can go. I have dinner with Dad at Olive Garden. We normally have dinner together on Tuesday nights after my regular Tuesday session with Dave, because Megan has yoga on Tuesdays. Dinner with Dad is always a quiet affair, because he has even less to say than I do. He doesn't have the most exciting job in the world. He's an accountant, and he knows I don't want to hear about Megan or the house he lives in with her or how they pass their time, so there's not much left to discuss. It was easier when Ty was with us, although Ty hated the Dad dinners and was always finding last-minute excuses not to show, because at least then we could talk about sports. Now we're down to one safe topic of conversation.
How's school? Dad asks.
I got a 71 on my calculus midterm, I blurt out. I don't know why I tell him. It's embarrassing, especially with my dad, who's obviously a bit of a numbers guy himself. I can't look at him when I say it. I'm sure my face is bright red, but I keep picking at the salad like everything is fine. Dad puts down his breadstick.
That sounds serious.
It is serious, I agree. My grade's down to at least an A-, which means I'm not going to be valedictorian.
Can you retake it?
He asks. No. Lie number 18.
I see.
He clears his throat, then goes back to eating the breadstick. I'm sorry, Dad, I say after a minute. And I am. I hate disappointing him. Even after everything, I care what he thinks.
It's not important,
he says, but he doesn't mean it. Dad's always going on about how hard you have to work to be the best, to excel at everything, to reach for the very top, the best grades, the best education, the best job, so that you can live up to your potential, he always says, which is where I read, so that you don't end up an accountant in Nebraska with a divorce and two, wait, make that one now, kids when you could have been so much more. We eat. Dad drinks 2 glasses of red wine, even though he hates wine. Then he pressures me into ordering dessert.
How's your mother?
He asks as I disassemble a piece of tiramisu. I could tell him about the crying thing, but he doesn't want to hear that. He doesn't want to know that she cries all the time, and that she doesn't get out of bed unless she has to be at work or church, and that she sleeps with Ty's old stuffed monkey clutched to her chest. He doesn't want to hear that she thinks Ty is still in the house, and I don't even know what he'd do if I told him what I saw in the basement. He wants me to say that Mom's okay. So I say, she's all right, lie number 19, and Dad pays the check. We put on our coats and wander out into the cold night air, and he hugs me stiffly, and then, as usual, we go our separate ways. 5. The house is dark when I get home. Mom must have already gone to bed, which isn't so unusual, even at 8 o'clock at night. She sleeps so she doesn't have to be awake, so she will be conscious of what's happened as little as possible. I wish I could sleep like that. I spend an hour doing homework, then I reach that time when normally I would go downstairs to watch TV. This is a dilemma. I haven't ventured into the basement in 4 days, not even to do laundry. I haven't watched TV. I haven't brought it up with Mom that maybe the cologne thing wasn't so ridiculous after all. Yes, I'm aware that I'm a total coward. I take out the journal Dave gave me. For a few seconds, I actually consider writing in it again, scribbling down a long confession about everything I haven't said out loud, about the ghost, about the text, about Stephen, about Ty, about me. But I can't make myself do it. So I stick the moleskin notebook under my mattress as a tribute to cliches and curl up on my bed for a while, reading A Beautiful Mind, which I can't get into. Then I try Contact by Carl Sagan, which is my favorite novel ever, but my eyes move across the page without finding meaning in the words. I keep thinking about the look on Ty's face when I threw the phone at him, startled and offended and a little sad. I'd never thrown anything at him before. We weren't like that. We always got along. Suddenly, I'm furious. I think, so what, I'm never going to go into the basement again? I'm going to tiptoe around my own house until I leave for college? I'm going to be scared of, what, a figment of my imagination? What am I, like 10 years old? Afraid of the dark? Get over yourself, Lex, I tell myself. Grow a pair. So I jump up. I march straight down into the basement and stand for a few minutes, glaring at that spot where Ty appeared the other night, at the small dent in the wall that is, of course, still there from where I chucked my phone at him. I make myself stand there for a full 5 minutes. I don't see anything weird. I don't smell anything weird. I just feel stupid. His bedroom door is open. I go to the doorway. The moon is shining through the window. I haven't been in Ty's room since we went in to get the clothes he was buried in, but it looks the same as I remember. His desk is cluttered with books and school stuff, clothes on the floor, shoes, a partially deflated basketball, a dusty old model airplane dangling from the ceiling that he and Dad built together when he was 11, pictures of his friends taped to the walls, posters of bands and movies he liked, and NBA players. As I step inside, his scent envelops me. Not just his cologne, but that slightly goat-like aroma he had, and his deodorant, which smells faintly minty, pencil shavings, dirty socks, wood glue. Ty. I swallow. It's like he's still here, not in a ghost-like way, but like it never happened. If I stay here, if I close my eyes, I can imagine that Ty is just out somewhere, and that he'll be back. I wish I could cry. That would be the appropriate thing to do at this moment, to remember my brother and cry. But I can't. I turn to go out, and that's when I see someone sleeping in his bed. The covers are lumped up around a figure on its side, back to me. My heart starts to pound. I know it's not Ty, I know it can't be, but in that moment, I want it to be. I want to see him again, even if it means I'm crazy. Maybe that's why I couldn't tell Dave, or why I can't write it down, because then they'll very definitely make me take the pills, and what happened the other night with the phone won't happen again, and I'll never see Ty, not ever, for as long as I live, and I don't believe in an afterlife, so I won't get to see him then either. I know this isn't the best reasoning, but I still think it. I creep around to the other side of the bed. I touch the shoulder of the person lying there and find it warm, moving slightly with each breath. Breathing. Alive. It's not him, I think, as I take the edge of the covers and start to pull them back. It's not him. And I'm right. It's not. It's my mother. She's sleeping, wearing a faded red Led Zeppelin t-shirt, an old one of Ty's. Lines of mascara are dried like tattoo ink down her cheeks, etched into the wrinkles near her eyes, marking the pillowcase. She looks old, small, worn out. I draw the covers back over her, then sit on the bed and watch her for a while, her breathing, the movements of her eyes behind her eyelids. What would she dream about in Ty's bed, surrounded by his stuff and his smell? I want to wake her up, to take her out of here, because it's not okay, her being here, it's not healthy. But I let her sleep, because, at least for the moment, she doesn't seem to be in pain. Sometimes I wonder if she wishes it was me who died instead of Ty, her snarky daughter instead of her socially acceptable son. I know she loves me, but if she could choose... But that's Ty's fault. He left her a note. As suicide notes go, it was short and to the point. It said, "Sorry, Mom, but I was below empty." He didn't write a note to Dad, or to any of his friends, or to me. He just left those 7 little words on a yellow post-it stuck to his bedroom mirror. His only explanation. It's still there. The police took it down for a while as evidence, but they came back and returned it to exactly where he'd left it. They'd taken a picture of the room so they would know where. So far, neither of us has had the guts to take it down. I stand up and cross to the mirror. Sorry, Mom, but I was below empty. I reach out. My fingers have just brushed the edge of the paper when I see Ty in the reflection of the mirror. He's standing right behind me. Ty. Again, I don't think about it. I don't stop to contemplate what a rational person might do in this situation. I don't calmly investigate. I run. I jerk away from the mirror, away from him, away, up the stairs, out the door, and before I know what's happened, I'm outside on the street, my shoes crunching the frozen snow as I run and run and run. This is not happening, is the thought that cycles through my brain. This is not happening. I get 3 blocks before I stop, to the edge of a park where Ty and I used to spend every summer afternoon when we were kids. I hunch over, panting, finally feeling the biting cold. I wasn't wearing a coat when I bolted out of my house, just a t-shirt and jeans, and the winter air against my bare arms is sharp and distantly painful. The moon is bright over my head. The park has a frozen quality to it, the swings hanging perfectly still, deserted. A car moves along the street, slowing as it passes me. I wipe my nose, straighten, and try to take a full breath. I don't know what I'm doing. Ty, in the house, in his room. This is not happening, I think. A shudder passes through me that has nothing to do with the cold. I feel a kind of resignation as I walk back. The front door is half open, waiting for me. I shuffle zombie-like down to Ty's bedroom, where my mother is still sleeping. Ty is not in the mirror. I notice immediately that the top right-hand drawer of his desk is open. I can't remember if it was open before, but now it strikes me as odd, out of place. Was Mom up rummaging around while I was gone, or was it like that earlier? Or was it someone else? This is not happening, I think. But it is. I kneel next to the bed and gently shake Mom by the shoulder. She gives a weak cry as she opens her eyes. It takes her a few seconds before she focuses on my face.
Oh, Lexi, she says. Is everything all right?
She glances around. I watch her expression change as she registers where she is. Ty's room. Ty is gone. Ty is dead. Grief floods her face.
I came down to wake him that morning, she says. He was right here. He seemed all right. I know. I should have sensed that something was wrong that day. I'm his mother. I should have been able to tell.
I never know what to say to this. She has her blame game and I have mine, the difference being that I actually have something to feel guilty about. It's cold down here, I tell her as I help her sit up. Let's get you upstairs. Later, after I've got her tucked away in her own bed and she's sleeping again, I slink back to the basement to investigate the open drawer. It's empty, except for a single item. A sealed envelope. A letter. My heart jumps, thinking that he might have written it to me. I didn't answer the text, so he wrote down what he wanted to say. His reasons, his accusations, maybe. His last words. The idea fills me with relief and terror. I turn the envelope over with unsteady hands, and that's when I see the name scrawled in Ty's terrible handwriting across the paper. For Ashley, it reads. 12th of February. The first time my brother tried to kill himself, almost 2 years ago now, was the day my parents' divorce was finalized. I don't know if he meant it as a kind of grand statement or what. I wasn't there for him that night either. I was at a movie with Beaker. I can't even remember which movie. I only know I wasn't present when he marched up to the kitchen sink with a family-sized bottle of Advil and proceeded to gulp down pill after pill after pill. He did it practically under our mother's nose as she sat with her back to him at the kitchen table, alternately studying for her nursing board exams, making her slow way through a giant stack of note cards labeled with dosages and parts of the human body and the definitions of different medical terminology, and studying the Bible, trying to come to peace with where it said that divorce was okay so long as there was adultery involved. At 42, Mom was the oldest student in her class at nursing school, but she was the best. She was focused, driven, determined to make a new life for herself post-dad. She didn't even look up when her 14-year-old son took 63 tiny maroon tablets of pain reliever, said goodnight to her, then went downstairs to his bedroom and went to sleep. He was disappointed when he woke up the next morning. He emerged from the basement with an expression I'll never forget, a kind of resigned, puzzled frustration that he hadn't simply floated away during the night.
"I'm not going to school today," he announced as we sat down to breakfast. "I don't feel good."
My mother, ever the nurse, even before she qualified to be one, felt his forehead. It was cool. She asked him some questions. Sore throat, headache, stomach pains. He shook his head and looked up at her, shrugged his thin, bird-like shoulders, and told her what he'd done. At the hospital, the most they could really do was put him in a room for observation. It was too late to pump his stomach. I sat in the corner and watched TV with him as the nurses came and went, checking his vitals, changing the saline and the IV. Every now and then, Mom burst in, tearful, in agony over the choice she was being forced to make about whether or not to stay with us all day or do her clinical rounds in the hospital, her final week of requirements for her nursing degree, without which she couldn't graduate.
"I'm okay," Ty told her,
and even smiled at her to prove his point, his face wan under the fluorescent hospital lights, his lips colorless as he formed the word, "Go."
"I'll be back," she promised again and again before dashing off.
I didn't know what to say to him that day. I slumped in the uncomfortable plastic chair and tried to think of some big sisterly advice that would draw him back from the edge. But I was 16 then. What did I know? I had my own problems, my own private miseries. And if I'd been honest, I would have admitted that the idea of checking out had crossed my mind a few times in the past gruesome year, between my dad leaving us for the cliché he'd met at the office, who was exactly half his age, and my mom going back to school, the house suddenly empty of adults in a way that felt implicitly wrong. But I never had a real plan to end my life. I was too afraid of dying, of the blackness, of ceasing to exist.
"It was stupid," he ended up saying to me that day when the silence grew thick between us.
I was relieved to hear him say it. "Yes, it was. Totally moronic," I agreed. And then we went back to watching World's Wildest Police videos on the TV that perched near the ceiling. The nurses came and went, my mother came and went, and we both wondered, but not out loud, whether our father was going to show up at all. In the end, he did. He was wearing a golf shirt, I remember. He'd come to take us home, since the hospital had decided to release Ty, and Mom still had 3 more hours of her clinicals. Dad also didn't seem to know what to say as he drove us back to the house. He drummed his fingers on the steering wheel, checked the rearview mirror, met my eyes, looked away, then cleared his throat.
"Tyler," he said as we pulled into the driveway. "Come home,"
Ty interrupted.
"Please, Dad, come home. Please."
My breath lodged itself in my chest. Ty never said things like that. He was angry with Dad. That was how he dealt. He'd always maintained that he hated Dad, that he was glad Dad was gone, that he didn't miss him.
"Please,"
he said again. And what about me, I thought. Did I want Dad to come home? Could we pretend that this past humiliating year had never happened, that he wasn't a liar and a cheater and an all-around pathetic excuse for a human being, that everything hadn't been turned upside down? Could we go back to the way things were before? Did I want to go back? Dad cleared his throat again. I waited for him to say, I can't, or I'm sorry, son, or something about how life is hard, but that doesn't mean we give up. But he didn't say anything. And he didn't stay, even though the doctor had said that Ty needed to be under strict surveillance for the next 24 hours, Dad didn't even get out of the car. He just looked at me and said,
call me if you need anything.
And I kind of nodded, and my eyes burned with furious tears that I didn't let fall, and I turned away and walked Ty up the steps into the house. Later, when Ty was sleeping, I went from room to room gathering anything that might be dangerous. Razor blades, pills, although we'd already established that this wasn't an effective method of offing yourself, rope. Then I unlocked the closet in the back of Dad's office and stared at the line of 3 hunting rifles in their cases. I checked to make sure none of them was loaded, and then I went to the shelf and swept every single bullet into a box with the rest of the stuff. I sealed the box with duct tape, labeled it Romance Novels, and hid it in the back corner of my closet under a pile of half-naked Barbie dolls I still had lying around. After that was done, I went to check on Ty, listened to him breathe, and tried to convince myself that he was going to be all right. Then I tiptoed back upstairs and sat at the kitchen table and finally allowed myself to cry. I could cry back then. I loved Ty. I loved him, and I had almost lost him. So I cried. Tears were still a part of my anatomy. They called him lucky that time. His body was able to metabolize the Advil. His liver was damaged, but would probably heal. Lucky, they kept saying at the hospital as they took his statement and ran the tests on him and acted, in general, like the whole thing was a stunt, like he'd tried some harebrained move on his bicycle. You're so lucky. Lucky, lucky you. Lucky was the last word my brother would pick to describe himself. But in the end, he nodded and told them they were right, so they would let him go. The Advil thing was a cry for help, they said, so they required him to see a therapist, who got my brother started on antidepressants and tried to get him to talk about his pain every week for the next year or so at $60 a pop, which our insurance didn't cover, but Mom convinced my dad to pay. And for 2 whole years, nothing much happened. Mom became a licensed nurse, Dad married the cliché, I got an 800 on the math section of the SATs, and everybody began talking about what college I would go to. Ty joined the basketball team. He started lifting weights, and his body filled out. His arms grew strong and muscled. He wore a Letterman's jacket when he swaggered through the halls at school. Girls liked him. People in general liked him. He was popular in a way that I never could have dreamed of being. And it was easy to forget that he'd ever been sad enough to down a bottle of pills. We only talked about it once, after that day at the hospital. It was about 2 weeks later, and we were at Denny's waiting for Dad to show up for breakfast. Dad was late. I was looking at Ty, really looking at him, and his eyes seemed glazed over, like he was staring out at his life through a pane of glass. "Are you okay?" I asked him. He glanced at me, startled.
I'm hungry. I wish Dad would get here already.
That's not what I mean, I said. Are you okay? His ears went red.
Oh, that. I told you that was stupid. I'm fine. Really, I won't do that again.
Okay, but I want you to promise me, if you ever feel like that again, like you want to...
I won't, he said.
But if you do, you have to tell me. Call me... Text me, wake me up at 3 a.m., I don't care. I want to know about it. I'm here for you. He didn't meet my eyes, but he nodded.
All right.
Promise, I said.
I promise.
Good, I said. But I worried that he was just telling me what he knew I wanted to hear. In the end, I shouldn't have concerned myself with whether he'd keep his promise. I should have thought about whether I'd keep mine. 6. Ashley Davenport, according to the yearbook, is a cheerleader. She's a sophomore. She has long blonde hair, or at least I think she does. It's hard to tell from the 1x1.5-inch black and white photo on page 173. She could be the one. There are 1,879 students at my high school, and 19 of them are named Ashley. About 1%. Over the past 2 days, I've already checked off Ashley Adams, who's practically married to her boyfriend, so clearly not the droid I'm looking for. Ashley Chapel, who's a senior, and I know her, and no way she dated Ty. And Ashley Chavez, whose raven's wing black hair doesn't match my memory of the girl Ty took to homecoming. So now I'm to the D's, and Ashley Davenport, blonde, sophomore, cheerleader. Ashley Davenport is today's objective. Also, it's Valentine's Day, which sucks. Last year, on the dreaded V-Day, I discovered a white paper daisy slipped between the upper slats of my locker when I arrived at school. It was paper, but I still stood there holding its green wire stem between my fingers, smiling stupidly, before I bent my head to smell the petals. It smelled like books, a heady mix of paper and ink and glue, a sweet knowledge. There was no note on the flower, no card, no name. A mystery. We weren't dating yet. We didn't officially start dating until June, but I knew the flower was from Stephen. He never confessed to leaving it there for me, but I knew. Because of something I'd said once when we were wandering around in a grocery store together that year, trying to find a last-minute gift for Mrs. Seidel, our chemistry teacher, who was in the hospital with cancer. "I don't get the point, really," I'd said as we contemplated the plastic-wrapped roses. "Why give a girl something that's supposed to represent love that's only going to wilt and die in a matter of hours?" Stephen laughed and said that was a pretty pessimistic way to view life, and I shrugged. Then he said,
"All the best things are like that, though, Lex. The most beautiful things. Part of the beauty comes from the fact that they're short-lived."
He picked up a bouquet of deep red roses, held it out to me.
"These will never be as beautiful as they are at this moment, so we have to enjoy them now."
I stared at him. He scratched the back of his neck, a little red-faced, then gave me a sheepish grin.
"Just call me a romantic," he said.
I wanted to say that there were some things in this world, some rare things, that were beautiful and stayed that way. But instead I took the bouquet out of his hand. "Okay, flowers it is," I said. And we laughed and bought the roses for Mrs. Seidel. Then, just a few weeks later, the paper daisy, a flower that would never die. I still have it, pinned to the edge of my corkboard above my desk at home. Today, when I go to my locker, there's no flower waiting. I knew there wouldn't be. I get out my books for first period and slam my locker closed. I tell myself that it was never going to work, Stephen and me, and it was for the best to cut it off when I did. Still, I can't help but look for him in the flux of incoming students in the hallway. So many of them are smiling, wearing red and pink and lugging boxes of candies to their oh-so-significant others. And finally, I see Stephen, walking with his head down, his backpack slung over one shoulder. He glances up. He sees me. He lifts his hand in a faint wave. I look away. I don't have time for this, I tell myself. I have a task to accomplish here, an objective. So I turn and wander toward the section of sophomore lockers, scrutinizing the blonde girls. One of them is Ashley Davenport, I'm pretty sure. I just don't know which one. I spot a group of Ty's old friends, the jock squad, off in a corner, laughing at something. They always seem to be laughing, like they're at a frat party already. I look at their faces and try to summon names, but I don't know Ty's high school friends the way I knew his friends from middle school, and I'm not good with names, so all I get is the guy with the faux hawk, the kid with the multiple gold medals sewn to his letterman's jacket, tall guy from the basketball team, Grayson, although I don't know if this is his first or last name, and a guy who's a swimmer or wrestler or something that makes his body ridiculously triangle-shaped. One of them, tall guy, looks up and notices me staring. This is the part where I should go over and ask them, "Hey, do you know an Ashley, the girl Ty took to homecoming? What's her last name? Is it Davenport?" But as I stand there looking at them, suddenly I'm thinking, there should be a space where Ty used to stand with them. But there isn't. They're arranged in a half circle with the requisite 12 inches between them, guy spacing, and there's no room for anyone else. The space where Ty used to be, they've closed it in. Which makes the freaking grief hole open up in my chest. I wait for it to pass, but it doesn't. Not for what feels like much longer than the normal 30 seconds. As usual, I start to feel like there's something physically wrong with my body. I can't breathe. My heart is beating too fast. I can't breathe. I can't breathe! And Tall Guy has definitely said something about me to Triangle Man because the members of the Jock Squad are all looking at me now with the same slightly wary expressions. Then somebody jostles me from behind, hard enough to knock one of my books to the floor, and all of a sudden, my lungs work again. "Hey!" I gasp to no one in particular. "Watch where you're going!" Stiffly, I bend to retrieve the book, but someone grabs it before I can. "I got it," he says. I inhale and exhale a couple of times to prove to myself that I can do it, then look up. "Oh, hi, Damien," I say. My book rescuer is Damien Whittaker, sophomore, one of those skin-and-bones types who hasn't grown into himself yet, all baggy shirt and greasy hair falling in his eyes and acne dotting his chin. He's a shy kid, inconspicuous, the kind who keeps to himself and doesn't seem to be interested in anything or anyone. A loner, according to the school's social strata. But these days, Damien is trying to be my friend. He and Ty were best buds a couple years back, the summer my dad took off from Megan's house. Damien and this other boy, Patrick, and Ty were like the three musketeers that year. They spent every available afternoon playing Halo and Guitar Hero and lounging around in our old playhouse listening to Led Zeppelin and the Doors. They thought they were being so classic and cool, but that was a long time ago. Damien hasn't darkened our doorstep since Ty started high school, and sports, and vying for Mr. Popularity. But Damien always makes an effort to smile and say hello when he sees me, as if he were my friend instead of my brother's, which means that lately he's been popping up all around school and trying to engage me in conversation. It's kind of sweet, even if it's the last thing I want. And it is the last thing I want. When I see Damien, all I can think about is how I'm never going to see Ty. When Damien tells me about a movie he saw last weekend, I think, Ty will never see that movie. He'll never play that new video game that Damien loves. He'll never pass his sophomore year. And Damien will. And it will not seem fair. "Oh, the horror," Damien says to me now. "What?" His smile is timid as he hands me back my book. "Heart of Darkness," he says. "What?" I ask again. "You're reading Heart of Darkness. There's this famous line at the end, 'Oh, the horror.'" I feel stupid, which is not a normal state of being for me. "Oh, right, yes, the horror."
"I liked that book," he says.
I'm about a quarter of the way through Heart of Darkness, an assignment for AP English, but so far it's exactly the kind of book I hate, where the story seems simple enough, interesting, but then I get to class and the teacher starts going on and on about the hidden meanings, the metaphors, the significance of the color yellow. All this meaning that the author was trying to say to the reader, like a message written in a secret language. Not my cup of tea. I don't know what to say to Damien. He looks expectant, like he and I are about to have a thought-provoking literary discussion of Joseph Conrad. I haven't finished reading it yet, I say. His smile drops.
Oh, spoiler alert. Sorry.
I'm so tired of the word sorry. Hey, do you know Ashley Davenport? I blurt out, because I've just remembered what I am doing in sophomore land. She's a cheerleader? Damien's eyes, which are a watery shade of gray, are instantly remote.
Yeah, he mumbles. I know her. Why?
Do you know where I can find her? He shrugs.
She's in my biology class.
Which biology class? I ask.
Mr. Slater's.
When? He glances up at the digital clock on the wall over our heads, which reads 6:56 a.m.
In like 4 minutes?
Thanks, I say quickly, already moving away from him. I have to get something out of my locker before the bell rings.
Okay,
he says simply, and smiles again.
See you around, Lex.
Bye. I make a beeline back toward my locker, to get the letter, to get down to the science wing and back to AP English in less than 4 minutes. I'm suddenly so freaked out by the prospect of finding the real Ashley, and then what am I going to do, huh? That when I get back to my locker, I almost miss it. The flower. A rose this time, stuck in the locker slats. It's still made from plain white paper, but more intricately built than last year. There are words written on it in faint pencil, a single sentence that I have to turn the flower around to read across the petals. I love you as the plant that never blooms, but carries in itself the light of hidden flowers. I close my eyes. Heat rushes to my face. Crap! What red-blooded girl wouldn't go weak in the knees at that? Oh, Stephen, I think. What are you doing? And now I have approximately 2 minutes. I should throw the rose away. I don't know if Steven's watching, but I should get rid of it in case he is. That would show him that it's over, because he clearly doesn't think it's really over if he could give me this flower. I walk to the trash at the end of the hall. My hand trembles moronically as I hold the flower over the gaping gray mouth of the trash can. There's a half-eaten breakfast burrito in there, some random papers and flyers. Try out for the school play. Gator Girls Basketball Team Bake Sale this Saturday. An assortment of empty soda cans, a broken pencil. Do it, I think. Let go. The bell rings. I sigh and walk back to my locker, where I tuck the paper rose into my backpack, into a side pocket, where it won't be crushed by all my other baggage. I grab the letter for Ashley and slip it into the front pocket of my 5-subject notebook. Not that I'm planning to give it to her right now if she turns out to be the right one. I can't think that far ahead. But because, for some illogical reason, I want to have the letter with me. Then I speed walk to Mr. Slater's classroom. If I remember correctly, that's room 121B. I arrive at 121B with a good minute to spare before the tardy bell rings, but before I can get a look inside, I'm run down by a redhead in a cheerleader uniform. She's in such a mad rush to get to the classroom before the second bell rings that she smacks right into me. Our books and papers go all over the carpet in front of the door. "I'm sorry," she says, as we're both on our knees, sorting out which stuff is whose. "I am so sorry." The bell rings.
"Ashley," I hear Mr. Slater's voice boom out from inside the classroom. "You're tardy, again."
She gives me a smile. "Sorry, Mr. S. Be right there," she calls back. "Ashley Davenport?" I ask. She looks startled. "Yes, you're Ty's sister, right?" My fame as the girl whose brother died has spread far and wide. I look Ashley over. She's a cheerleader, all right, and a sophomore, and pretty, with large royal blue eyes and skin so pale it has a translucent quality, so clear I can see a faint blue vein branching out under the surface of her temple and disappearing into her hairline. But the hair is all wrong. It's too short, pulled back into a tight ponytail that ends in a nub that barely brushes the back of her neck, and it's the color of a coil of copper. Red. She's not the girl with the long blonde hair I saw Ty dancing with that night. Wrong, Ashley. I let out the breath I was holding. "That's me," I say to answer her previous question. I hand over her biology notebook and straighten up. "Is this mine?" she asks, and I see she's got the envelope from Ty, frowning now because there's her name written right on it. I snatch it out of her hand. "No, it's mine." And with no more explanation, I'm on my feet, heading off at a half-jog because I'm late, too. For English. For Ty. For everything. I'm too late. 7. Stephen is in my English class. Of course he is. Stephen and Eleanor and Beaker are in all my honors classes. There was a time when that was a good thing, a great thing even, but not today. I'm 5 minutes late, but the desk I usually sit at, the one on the far right between Stephen and Beaker and in front of Elle, is still empty, waiting for me. Stephen looks up and smiles, and I feel my face heating again, thinking about the rose. Crap. Mrs. Blackburn stops talking and stares at me from her perch at the edge of her desk, puzzled by my highly unusual tardiness. Sorry, I mumble, and then I slink to the back of the classroom and find a seat on the left. I can't deal with my friends right now, especially Stephen. Mrs. Blackburn continues the lecture she was giving. She's starting us on an exercise in etymology, she says, the study of the origin of words. She shows us a website where you can type in any word and it will spit out the word's roots, its definition, where and how that word originated, and how the use of the word changed over time. In conjunction with our Heart of Darkness reading, she demonstrates how the website works using the word heart, which goes back to the Old Norse hjarta, and the word darkness, Old English deorknusa, and takes us back through the history of each word. So, class, Mrs. Blackburn says when she's done with the general history lesson about the birth of the English language, what are some other words that you associate with Heart of Darkness so far? I raise my hand, which surprises her because I'm not typically so quick to volunteer in this setting. Not my cup of tea, remember? Then suggest the word horror, which the website tells us comes from early 14th century French. Oh, la horreur. Mrs. Blackburn looks pleased that I have apparently already finished the book and know the significance of the word. Thank you, Damien. Then she sends us off on the class laptops to look up our own set of words. Research a word that's been on your mind, she instructs. I stare at the blank screen for a long time before I actually type in a word that's on my mind. Ghost. Noun. Origin. Before 900. Middle English ghost, noun. Old English Gast. Cognate with German Geist, spirit. Definition 1. The soul of a dead person, a disembodied spirit imagined, usually as a vague, shadowy, or evanescent form, as wandering among or haunting living persons. Definition 2. A mere shadow or semblance, a trace. Definition 3. A remote possibility. As in, there's not even a ghost of a chance that what I saw, what I've been seeing, I guess, is a more accurate description, as it's happened 2 times now, is real. It seems real, in the moment, it feels real, but it is not real. Ghosts do not exist. I am a rational person. I know this. Which leads me to hallucination. Noun. Origin, 1640-50. Latin, hallucination. Stem of silent H. Hallucinatio, a wandering of the mind. Definition 1. False or distorted perception of objects or events with a compelling sense of their reality, usually resulting from a mental disorder, or drug. No, pretty squeaky clean drugs-wise, I don't even like to take painkillers. The objects or events so perceived. See also, delusion. A lapse of sanity. A break. This seems like a far more likely explanation. I open my notebook and stare at the edge of the Ashley letter peeking out of the front pocket, the way the ink is slightly smeared on the letter Y. Ty was a lefty. He always had this smudge on the side of his hand at the end of the school day from dragging his hand through everything he wrote. For Ashley. Not to Ashley, but for her. For. Preposition. Origin. Before 900. From the Proto-Germanic Führer, Old Saxon Fury, Middle Dutch Vor. Definition 1. With the object or purpose of. Definition 2. Intended to belong to or to be used in connection with. Definition 3. suiting the purposes or needs of. Definition 4. In order to obtain, gain, or acquire. Definition 5. Used to express a wish, as of something to be experienced or obtained. 4 has too many meanings. All right, class, Mrs. Blackburn says abruptly. That's enough time, I think, to ponder the significance of a word. Let's share. I can't share this. Ghost? Hallucination? 4? Hello, class, I'm a crazy person. I sit quietly panicking while Mrs. Blackburn begins to wander between the rows of desks, occasionally stopping and gathering a word from a student. Baseball from Rob Milton, beautiful from Jen Peterson, book from Alice Kaizig. We're a terribly original bunch, and apparently stuck on the bees. What I hope that you're coming to understand as you study etymology is that a word is not simply a word, Mrs. Blackburn says, with that teacherly touch of drama, like this is life-changing stuff she's giving us here. She's that kind of teacher, the type who inflates everything, calls us by our last names instead of our first, so that our conversations sound more formal, stresses the importance of each book we read, each essay we write, like it's the most important thing for us to know before we head out into the big, bad world. We will become cultured intellectuals if it kills her. She continues, each word has a specific history, a context, a slow evolution of meaning. Most of the words we use today come from a clash of cultures, Norman against Saxon, Latin versus Germanic, smooth against guttural. She stops next to Eleanor. Give me a word, Miss Green. Brave, Elle says, which is of course a word that Elle would come up with. Elle once caught a guy trying to steal the license plate off the back of her car on the street outside her house, and ended up chasing him through the neighborhood with a baseball bat, yelling like an Amazonian warrior queen. Elle is fearless. French, am I right? Queries Mrs. Blackburn. Yes. And what do you like about this word, brave? I like that it's derived from a verb, Elle answers. Brave isn't something you are, it's something you do. It comes from action. I appreciate that. Excellent, Mrs. Blackburn says, moving on. She turns around and heads back up the row. Mr. Blake, she says, a word. Stephen clears his throat. His face goes slightly pink, but his voice doesn't waver when he answers,
I picked love.
Mrs. Blackburn widens her eyes and smiles. Love? So that's what's on the young man's mind.
It's Valentine's Day,
he explains with a hint of a smile.
So I'm thinking about it, yes?
His gaze touches mine and then moves quickly away. Love as a verb or a noun?
A verb. He says,
I love you as the plant that never blooms, but carries in itself the light of hidden flowers. Crap. Mrs. Blackburn nods. And where does the word love come from?
Old English, he reads off his laptop. Luvian, to cherish, show delight in, approve, which comes from the old High German, Luben, which meant something like joy.
Something like joy, Mrs. Blackburn repeats like she's reciting a poem. Wonderful. How about you, Miss Riggs? I'm startled, and I'm not ready. Why would she call on me? I'm at the other side of the freaking room. Is my association with Stephen that ingrained in everyone around us? What? I ask, like maybe I didn't hear her correctly. What's your word? Oh, mine's not very good, I say. She waits. I sigh. My eye falls on a word on my screen. Delusion, I say as my fingers type it in. See the seat of my pants and see me flying by it. From the Latin, delusio, it means a belief that, though false, has been surrendered to and accepted by the whole mind as a truth. Interesting, Mrs. Blackburn says thoughtfully. What made you pick delusion? Well, we were talking about love, right? Love is a classic example of delusion. Mrs. Blackburn chuckles. Oh, I see. Not a romantic, then, are you? No, I say flatly. I don't believe in romantic love. Why not? She asks. Here we go. Because what we associate with the idea of love is purely chemical. It can be broken down into scientifically proven phases. It starts with a dose of testosterone and estrogen, what we would think of as lust, followed by the goofy, lovesick phase, which is a combination of adrenaline, dopamine, and a drop in serotonin levels, which, by the way, makes our brains behave exactly like the brains of crack addicts, and ends up, if we make it through phases 1 and 2, with attachment, where the body produces oxytocin and vasopressin, which basically make us want to cuddle excessively. It's science. That's all. Hmm, says Mrs. Blackburn. That's quite the speech, Alexis. Stephen smiles at me again, but it's a sad smile this time, a pitying smile. It makes me mad. So I keep talking. All this Valentine's Day stuff comes from big business capitalizing on the delusion of love. All the candy, the candlelit dinners, the flowers. I meet Stephen's gaze and hold it for a second, and then look away. It generates more than $1 billion in revenue every year because people want to believe in love, but it's not real. Mrs. Blackburn shakes her head, frowning. But have you considered the notion that what we believe in, what we choose to believe in, is real? It becomes real for us. I push my glasses up on my nose and stare at her blankly. Perhaps you're right, she adds. And what we feel as love is nothing more than a combination of certain chemicals in our bodies. But if we believe that love is this powerful force that binds us together, and if this belief brings us happiness and stability in this tumultuous world, then what's the harm? My chin lifts, like I have something to prove here. Maybe I do have something to prove. In my experience, love doesn't bring happiness and stability, but believing in love can cause a substantial amount of harm. Like with my parents. Like with my brother. Mrs. Blackburn straightens her wedding ring on her finger for a minute before speaking again. I find that love is a concept much like bravery, Miss Riggs. I, for instance, have been married to the same man for 32 years, and in all that time I haven't felt in love with him every day, not in the way love is described in romantic comedies and romance novels, but I have loved him. Love is a choice I've made, a verb, and that, because I believe in it, because I act on it, is real. Love is a very real thing to me. The class goes silent. The discussion has veered off into weird, too personal territory. We don't want to think about the romantic lives of our teachers. I stare at my hands for a minute. I know I shouldn't argue with her. I don't even know why I want to argue with her, because I don't want to let Stephen get away with the rose, but I can't seem to help myself. There was this study, I say finally, where a scientist made people fall in love with a simple series of actions. He had them talk about certain personal topics and look into each other's eyes for a determined period of time and have this specific physical contact, and if you put those factors all together, then bam, anyone can fall in love with anyone. Some of the people in that study got married later, and they had a lower divorce rate than the national average. It's that simple. You do these certain things, you fall in love. It's biology. Period. That people believe in it, as anything else, is just proof of how deeply ingrained the delusion is in our society. Mrs. Blackburn gazes at me, all red-faced, like she'd like nothing better than to send me to the principal's office, but she can't think of a good enough reason. Being the official rain cloud over the V-Day love parade is not going to cut it. The back of my throat feels tight. I swallow against it. The round clock over the doorway ticks off its seconds. Then Jill, always the one to come to the rescue in moments of social awkwardness, says,
"Hey, I have a word. Moist. I hate the word moist. It just sounds yuck. Who would come up with a word like moist?" She refers to her notebook. It turns out that it comes from something called Vulgar Latin, whatever that means. Muscidus, which means slimy, musty, moldy. Yuck, right? And then somewhere in the 13th century, it morphed into the old French word moist, which means damp. Mrs. Blackburn blinks, like she'd forgotten what she was going to say, then gives a short laugh. Thank you, Beaker. I've never liked that word either, Mrs. Blackburn says as she glides smoothly back to the front of the class. Something about the way it sounds is unpleasant, I agree. She laughs again. The study of words always brings out an examination of our feelings, which I think has become evident today, hasn't it? That's what words do. At the basic level, they are simply a collection of symbols grouped together in order to represent an object. C-H-A-I-R represents this. She puts her hand on the back of her empty seat. Chair. But each word represents something different for each of us. The bell rings. For Monday, she says, raising her voice above the shuffle of papers and feet, write 1,000 words about the meaning of one word and how the word makes you feel and why. Oh, brother. The class gives a group sigh. Class dismissed, she says. Enjoy the rest of your St. Valentine's.
Hey, Lex, wait up.
Beaker's running to catch me as I flee the classroom. I stop in the hall and wait. She pulls up in front of me, her bright, curly hair falling wildly around her shoulders and getting stuck in her hoodie as she puts it on. She tugs at it and smiles breathlessly.
Elle and I, we're going to have an anti-Valentine's Day party at Elle's house tonight. It's not a party, really. It's an unparty. Just pizza and a couple of slasher movies and maybe a game or two of Settlers of Catan.
She bites her lip and stares up at me hopefully.
Will you come?
I love Settlers of Catan. I love pizza. I even love slasher films. For all of 2 seconds, I let myself imagine it. Me and Beaker and Elle and our PJs in Elle's basement, the way things used to be. And maybe I'd tell them. We'd curl up on Elle's old ratty couch with mugs of hot chocolate, and I'd spill out everything that's been going on. Mom and her theory that Ty's still in our house, and how I'm not so sure now that she's wrong. The letter to Ashley so I could ask them what they think I should do with it. And maybe I'd even talk about what happened that night Ty checked out. With Stephen. With the text. But the instant I really let myself picture it, I feel the hole coming on. If just thinking about this stuff makes me feel like I'm going to die, what would saying it out loud do? And then I consider how Beaker tends to laugh when she's nervous. I imagine Elle's face, that look she gets when someone has said something too ridiculous to be believed, and I think, no, no, I can't tell them. I can't.
Lex,
Beaker prompts gently. I shake my head. I should be home with my mom tonight, you know? And that would be true if my mom wasn't working tonight, so it's not technically a lie. Beaker's mouth goes into a frustrated line. I can see her considering her options and then deciding there are none. Nothing trumps sad, lonely mother. Anyway, why aren't you going out with Antonio? I ask. She tucks a curl behind her ear.
Oh, we're not together anymore. He's a skeeze.
I'm sorry, I say lamely. I never liked Antonio. He was the kind of guy that always wanted to make out with Beaker, but never seemed to want to talk to her. He was unworthy. Beaker waves her hand like she's dismissing the thought of him, makes a psht sound.
Well, love isn't real, like you said, right? And Antonio's hormones decided to react chemically with someone else.
That sucks.
Yeah, it kind of does, she says with a bitter laugh. Are you sure you won't hang out with us? I miss you. We all miss you, Lex. That was boss, the way you kind of took down Mrs. Blackburn.
We all, she said. Is Stephen going to be there? I ask.
He doesn't have to be,
she answers, which means yes, he's supposed to be. Of course he is. He's their friend, even though he's no longer my boyfriend. But she'll uninvite him if it would make me feel more comfortable.
I can't face Steven, but I can't kick him out of the party either. Like I said, I have to keep my mom company tonight, I say. Sorry, it sounds fun. Okay, well. She puts her hand on my shoulder.
Hey, if there's anything I can do, if you ever want to talk...